If you're a baby boomer, you can probably remember thinking marijuana will be legalized any time now, and thinking that around 1971 or so. Didn't happen then, and on the federal level, it has not happened yet, and may not. Marijuana's up and down and up history is well demonstrated. Just by last week, on Monday, January 1st, recreational pot sales started in California in retail stores. 3 days later, the U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced that the federal look-the-other-way policy on state pot laws was over, and the U.S. attorneys in each state could use their discretion. As our guest this hour shows, marijuana has taken a bit of a roller coaster ride in the last 5 decades. Emily Dufton is the author of Grassroots, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Marijuana in America. Emily lives near Washington, D.C. She holds a Ph.D. in American Studies from George Washington University. And if you're thinking this sounds familiar, this is the second book called Grassroots we've talked about. Nick Johnson focused his work on cannabis in the western United States and visited last October. So we'll keep those apart. Emily Dufton, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
In your analysis, is there really any other substance in our history that had such an up and down and up ride as the one you analyze here?
Well, save for alcohol's federal prohibition, no, there really isn't anything. And, of course, alcohol is quite different because when it was outlawed and then re-legalized, it was done so through 2 constitutional amendments, and in that way kind of ended the discussion and argument about it there. Marijuana is the only substance in American history that has continually been battled over, and the constant debate over where it stands in relationship to federal laws, state laws, and personal use. This is a truly unique substance in that way.
And why are the feelings so strong? I still have the vivid memory of my teacher in 5th grade telling us to cross out the line about marijuana in our drug guide where it said not a hallucinogen. I mean, people have always been kind of scared of marijuana. Why?
It's a fascinating conversation. And from all the conversations that I had with people while writing this book, I've come to believe that it's because there are so many layers of meaning given, sort of laid upon this specific drug, for people who support increasing its use and for people who are opposed to it. Marijuana represents a lot about how we feel about our country and about the populace of our country as a whole. For people who support the drug, marijuana represents freedom. Freedom to do what you want out of the police eye. It also represents a sense of social justice. There have long been decades of racist arrest rates for this substance, and legalization represents a sense of social justice and a return to a sense of equality and egalitarianism. But for people who are opposed to it, marijuana represents not only maybe the fraying of the moral fabric of this country, but also a sense of fear. If it's legalized, we don't know if the driver on the highway next to us is high. We're unsure of how it might affect children. This is the only substance that so many feelings and really strong feelings have been laid upon over and over and over again over the decades.
And there are some assumptions, I gather, made by non-users of the users and the caliber of people who would be using marijuana.
Precisely. And I think even though 64% of Americans currently support legalization of the drug, really only about 12% of Americans smoke it regularly. That's a pretty small amount. So people have ideas about the people who use this drug, and people who use the drug also have ideas about people who don't.
Indeed, they do. You do focus on marijuana activists, and I'm guessing there was no shortage of colorful figures in that category.
Absolutely. And that's what really drew me to this story as a whole. Once I started talking to people, I realized that even if they were participating in their activities 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, they were still very passionate about this subject and remembered everything that they did as though it were yesterday. So being able to talk to a lot of people who were involved in these movements, who are still alive, and who were really excited about finally having their story told, well, that's a goldmine for any historian.
Absolutely. Number one on the list is Lowell Eggemeyer, who made a dull Sunday in San Francisco in 1964 a little more interesting. What did he do?
Oh, yeah, he's great. He decided that, you know, long before the hippies kind of came to that city, he decided that he wanted to challenge the state's laws against marijuana. So he walked into the San Francisco Hall of Justice, lit up a joint, and said, "I would like to legalize marijuana, and I'm here to be arrested." And indeed he was. He was incarcerated for over a year.
And wow. So in the 60s, there was a big embrace of marijuana. He was just one of many people. What were the factors that made people feel so strongly about that drug at that time?
Well, the big thing was certainly its interrelation with the counterculture and the anti-war movements. Marijuana had been increasing in recognition and popularity throughout the 50s with the Beat Movement, but it had been very much so limited to sort of avant-garde urban areas like New York and San Francisco. As trafficking routes kind of became reestablished in the wake of World War II, the drug started to spread. And as with most things in the 1960s, it really found its home on college campuses and with young people. So people started to, you know, use the drug more, experiment with the drug more, and they started to realize that all the things that they were hearing about marijuana, particularly from the federal government, that it would automatically make you become addicted to heroin, that it would lead to suicide, that it would lead to apparently terrible things like miscegenation, they weren't as true as they as the government says they were. And that led them to question other things, such as the validity of segregation or the necessity of the Vietnam War. The young people's questioning of marijuana ultimately spread into their questioning of a lot of larger functions of the federal government, such as, and they began to participate more in the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and the counterculture. It was all interconnected.
So the question authority move of the time was on a number of things, marijuana among them.
Absolutely.
All right, we're going to be talking more with Emily Dufton, a historian, about her book, Grassroots, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Marijuana in America. You can decide for yourself where we are at the moment, but the laws seem to be easing at the state level, and we have some doubts about the federal level. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange by phone or by email. We'll be back with Emily Dufton and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about marijuana in a historical sense, generally since the 1960s is where Emily Dufton picks up the story, to look at how we've been dealing with marijuana as a legal or not substance. Her book is called Grassroots, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Marijuana in America. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange by phone at 800-838-3760 to join the conversation. Send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. A lot of stuff that came out of the 60s, for me, always comes back to the fact that there were so many young people at that time because of the baby boom. And I wonder if there was some element, Emily, of baby boomers embracing this thing that was not their parents' drug. It wasn't martinis, whiskey sours, or Budweiser.
Exactly. That was huge. Alcohol was very much so seen as the drug of the previous generation, and indeed the drug of the war hawks, the people who were really pushing for the war in Vietnam. Marijuana seems so entirely different from alcohol and alcohol's effects. It truly represented an enormous generational shift.
Let's talk about some of the other figures involved here, because you do tend to focus on activists. How central was Allen Ginsberg to the marijuana boom of the 60s?
He was huge. He was huge. It's hard to really describe the effect that he had. By the time the mid-1960s rolled around, Ginsberg was an incredibly prominent and well-respected poet with numerous accolades and awards to his name. And so when he embraced the legalization movement by supporting LEMAR, which stands for Legalized Marijuana, the movement that formed in the wake of Lowell Egemeyer's arrest, he basically gave it a national platform. When he went back to New York after spending a year in California, 1965, he brought the movement to the East Coast and sort of gave it to the burgeoning counterculture that was there as well. He didn't stay with the movement forever. By the Summer of Love and the Human Being in 1967, he had actually moved on to supporting Hare Krishnas and the burgeoning psychedelic movement. But without Ginsberg's support of the marijuana legalization platform, it probably wouldn't have taken off as immensely as it did in the mid-60s.
And with Ginsberg and other figures involved, the demonstrations in favor of marijuana legalization got pretty creative. Can you give us a flavor of some of those?
They really did. They really did. Ginsberg was very associated with what was known as the Peace Bookstore in the Lower East Side. The guy who hosted the Fugs, he was a big part of that as well. And so they would produce literature. There was a lot of sort of hand-drawn and mimeographed pamphlets that they would hand out calling for an end to all marijuana prohibition. They would have creative marches in front of the police station or on Tompkins Square Park. Ginsburg was probably best known for wearing a huge sandwich board that just said in huge letters, "Pot is fun."
I laugh at this part of the book because my father used to warn my sister to stay out of Tompkins Square Park because he thought it was dangerous. I think he had other motives.
Probably.
No doubt. So another couple of figures here to talk about, Keith Strop and Blair Newman. How different were their approaches to getting marijuana legalized?
Totally different. Two really interesting guys. And they sort of represent the marijuana legalization movement away from San Francisco and New York and straight to Washington, D.C., where in some ways it's still centered now, though of course there are state-based capitals as well. Strop is best known for founding NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, and he is still very active in the organization today, constantly on Twitter and things like that. But he was very straight-laced in his own way. He came from the Midwest, from a prominent conservative family in Illinois, and after he graduated from undergrad, he basically drove to D.C., said, "This is what I'm going to do." And as soon as he started smoking pot, which occurred shortly after he moved to the city, he thought, you know, what the world needs, or at least what this country needs, is an organization that represents smokers' rights in the same way that that other organizations are representing consumer rights, right? People deserve a drug that's free from toxins or pollutants. They deserve to be treated like consumers, like taxpaying, you know, adults and things like that. And he started NORML to basically become the adults sort of protectors, or the protectors of adults' rights to smoke pot. Blair Newman was quite different. He decided that what he really wanted to do was create a way to support marijuana smokers' rights, but that would also embark on all of the other sort of forms of countercultural activism that he was also interested in. And he actually found a way to monetize a marijuana activism by selling hemp-based rolling papers and through an organization that he called Amorphia that also ultimately ended up moving to the West Coast. By doing that and by monetizing marijuana legalization, anyone who bought Amorphia's rolling papers was essentially helping to promote the legalization cause as well as everything else that he was interested in, ecological causes, women's rights, anything else that the counterculture was really centered upon.
Emily Dufton is a historian and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book about marijuana through history, recent history, is called Grassroots, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Marijuana in America. So we're starting with the 60s here when it really became a popular drug among young people. Are there polls from that time that show some support for legalizing pot?
You know, there aren't as many. I don't think Gallup even thought about it at the time. But I guess from what I've heard from the activists that I've spoken to and from the incredibly prolific writers in the underground press, the myriad newspapers and underground print that was available at the time shows that at least among certain people, marijuana legalization was almost taken as a given. Of course you support this thing. How could you not? Now, as far as the wider American public is concerned, that's questionable. But even by 1969, someone smoking a joint appeared on the cover of Life magazine, and it was sort of known that marijuana use had spread away from urban, from college campuses, and into basically the middle class. There were a lot of suburban middle class adults who were also using the drug, and in that sense, there was kind of a tacit acknowledgement that the war on drugs, or at least the war on marijuana, which had not yet started in earnest, really maybe would never take shape. It was sort of suggested that, yes, this is something that America will just have. It's not a problem.
And here's where we can go from one up to a down, because Richard Nixon came into office around this time, and he had a hand in turning the tide. How did he feel about marijuana?
He most certainly did. He really despised the drug, and not just because, you know, it was a drug, but because of its ties to the counterculture and its ties to what he viewed as the people who were very destructive to the great American project, which he saw himself as a vessel or protector of. You can take that for what you will. But anyone who disagreed with Nixon and his policies, he believed was using drugs and was, you know, an agent of communism and all these other things. He really placed a lot of negative meanings onto marijuana and really despised the drug. And of course, through the targeting of marijuana use, he could also target his detractors. So he began to not formalize laws against the drug yet in the very beginning of his first term, but to start to suggest that maybe this is something we should look into. So in 1970, when he has Congress pass the Controlled Substances Act, which is the act that devises and places drugs into five schedules, one through five, the most dangerous being one, the least dangerous being in five, he really urges marijuana to be placed in Schedule One, if only temporarily. And then he also gets basically what is a two-year, multi-million-dollar examination of the drug and its role in America performed by a 13-member commission called the Schaefer Commission, because he believes that the Schaefer Commission, led by Raymond P. Schaefer, a Republican from Pennsylvania, will find such negative information about the drug that it will support his claims that the drug should be outlawed, banned, and totally kicked out of America.
But then the Schaefer Commission comes out with a report that's more than 1,000 papers that says what? 1,000 pages, I mean.
Says the exact opposite of what Nixon wants to hear. It says that marijuana users and non-marijuana users are basically identical. The drug causes no sense of violent tendencies, and that ultimately the drug should be decriminalized, maybe not legalized, but decriminalized nationwide.
We are talking to Emily Dufton, a historian from Washington, D.C., talking about her book, Grassroots, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Marijuana in America. Quite a roller coaster ride since she begins tracking the story in the mid-1960s. You can join the conversation on The Exchange. Were there times when you thought that, oh, yeah, we'll legalize this any day now across the country, and thought that maybe 45 years ago? A lot of people did. You can join the conversation on The Exchange with some context about now or then. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. At this point in the book, you do get to Oregon and decriminalization, which is a clue that there's often been a yin-yang between state and federal laws over marijuana.
Absolutely. Oregon is really a pioneer in this field. The 1960s generation that starts to question the validity of anti-marijuana laws, well, by the early 1970s, they've realized that they have a real sense of political momentum, and they want to use their voice. So there's a young person named Stephen Kefauri who runs for he runs for elected office in the state of Oregon. And while he's canvassing Portland, his hometown, he realizes that there's all these young people who he knocks on the door to you know, state his peace, and they're running around inside, and as soon as they open the door, he can smell the marijuana, and he realizes that they're all terrified. Anytime they hear someone knocking on the door, they don't know. They're scared of getting busted. So Kefauri takes the legalization or decriminalization of marijuana in Oregon as his personal platform and makes a promise to his constituents that they won't have to be paranoid anymore. And as soon as he arrives in the State House in Salem, he's actually sort of given this task of discussing the recommendations of the Schaefer Commission, which were released in 1972. And if he and the rest of his colleagues are able to enact decriminalization in Oregon. And he has a kind of surprising ally in Stafford Hansel, who comes from Umatilla, I believe that's how it's pronounced, county.
Umatilla County, yeah.
Umatilla, all right, thank you. So he's this pretty, you know, staunch Republican conservative, but even he says the effects of marijuana laws are more negative than the benefits of them. They make young people distrust the police. They don't do any good. So Hansel and Kefauri end up working together to pass the nation's first decriminalization laws in Oregon in 1973. They're very much so the pioneers of this movement that then spreads to 11 more states in the next 4 years.
So it seemed like there was a bit of an update. This is probably the point in history when a lot of people who were alive at the time can remember thinking, oh, yeah, marijuana is going to be legal really soon. And it didn't happen. And there's a striking phrase you write in here: the movement's peak also brought with it the movement's downfall. What went wrong?
Oh, quite a few things. The difference between decriminalization and legalization, as we've seen from the country's experiment with decrim in 40 years ago and legalization today, is that decriminalization is kind of tricky in that it doesn't really set up any system for monitoring or ensuring that people who are participating in this new economy are abiding by any sense of protective laws. So as soon as the first decriminalization laws started being passed, a lot of paraphernalia manufacturers saw a real opportunity here. The economy wasn't great in the 1970s, as we know, and paraphernalia was actually one of the few growth industries. So all of a sudden, you have people across the country, from, you know, people making things in their garage to huge international, people who are bringing all these other things, who are marketing pipes and bongs and rolling papers and books and games and all this other stuff to anyone who will buy it, including kids. And rates of adolescent marijuana use begin to skyrocket because there's really no system of control. By 1979, I think 9% or 11% of high school seniors reported smoking pot every day. Children as young as 13 reported that the drug was very easy to get. And paraphernalia manufacturers by 1977 were bringing in over $250 million a year. And in today's dollars, that's $1 billion. It really was a huge industry. But without any regulation or oversight, and with rising rates of adolescent drug abuse, marijuana abuse specifically, that basically spelled disaster for the decriminalization movement as a whole.
Which has happened, it seems like, a couple times since. I know when there was the discussion of legalization in Oregon, one of the major cases made against was that the edibles are so cute that kids are going to want them.
Exactly. And that's one of the biggest shifts you see today. I feel as though the legalization laws that have been passed since 2012 are constantly building on one another, and states that are in the process of reviewing or passing new legalization laws have witnessed what other states have done and have tried to improve on any mistakes. So, for example, Colorado, which is one of the first states to pass in 2012, had a real problem with children eating what appeared to be harmless edibles, harmless candy, and going to the emergency room or calling the poison hotline because it was actually, a cannabis edible. California, which, as you said in the beginning of this show, just opened its first dispensaries for legal sales on January 1st, have very strict limits on the amount of THC available in each individual serving of an edible. It can't use the word candy in any marketing language. It can't have bright, shiny colors or cartoons or anything like that. Anything that would specifically appeal to kids has been specifically outlawed by the California legalization law, which I see as a sense of flexibility and improvement over everything that we witnessed happening in the 1970s.
Emily Dufton's our guest on The Exchange. Her book is Grassroots, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Marijuana in America. So back in time, we were talking about the paraphernalia of the 70s and how it began to look attractive enough that they were had 11% of high school seniors who said reported smoking marijuana on a regular basis by 1979. Jimmy Carter was the president then. He supported decriminalization, came from Georgia, and the backlash came from Georgia, too. Tell us about the Shewhart family.
The backlash is fascinating. Right. So also in Atlanta, same place that, as we know, brought us Jimmy Carter, there was a family of known liberals, also academics. Her husband worked at Emory University and taught English. And there's a woman named Marcia, nicknamed Keith Shewhart. She has three children, and her oldest daughter had started to go through a couple of personality changes when she was about 12 years old. And Shewhart really wasn't sure what was going on, but she was really worried, and she wasn't quite sure that it was just the sort of normal moroseness of adolescence. On the night of her daughter's 13th birthday party, the kids were all acting pretty weird. There were cars full of older teens driving by asking where the party was. One of the children, bumped into her. She was trying to use the telephone, just a big mess. And that night, after everyone had left, Shewhart and her husband are walking through their yard, and they find joints and bottles of malt liquor and wine coolers and things like that. And they really get scared because they were living in what appeared to be this sort of perfect suburban community, untouched by the troubles of the world. And here were their perfect suburban kids using drugs, including alcohol, although that doesn't seem to worry her as much. Her biggest concern was about marijuana. So being a PhD and being a researcher, she starts to try to figure out what's going on. And all of the literature that the federal government has on marijuana doesn't specifically detail its effects on kids, but it does say that the effects of pot are very, very scary. It can cause boys to grow breasts. It can render girls infertile. And she's just terrified. So building on her, you know, sort of understanding of 1960s activism, she basically forms a consciousness-raising group with fellow parents in her neighborhood, the parents of other kids who are at the party. They get together, share information, and basically try to stop decriminalization in its tracks because they're scared of its effects on kids.
And they have a great deal of success for a couple of reasons we'll get into in just a few moments. We're talking to Emily Dufton about her book, Grassroots, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Marijuana in America, a fascinating tracking of the rising and falling fates and fortunes of marijuana, and obviously lots of relevance to our time as well. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and talk more with Emily, and if you'd like to join us, we'll take phone calls and emails from you when we return in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about marijuana once again, but not so much in the current sense as we did in the first hour, but talking about it in the historical sense. Emily Dufton is a historian based in the Washington, D.C. area. She's taken a look back at the fates and fortunes of marijuana since it really sort of came into center stage in the 1960s. Her book is called Grassroots, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Marijuana in America. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we talk about that moment in the 1970s. When a lot of people thought legalization is going to happen any old time now, and it didn't, and it hasn't on a federal level yet. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we were talking about some of the lash and backlash where people thought it was going to happen. We had decriminalization. We had rising rates of teen use of marijuana, the parent movement, which went against it, the placement of marijuana on Schedule One under the Drug Control Act of 1970. There was also a key player brought down in the Carter administration in the late 70s. Who was Peter Bourne, and what was it that discredited his work?
Peter Bourne was Carter's chief drug advisor. He was also a medical doctor and a psychiatrist who had been one of Carter's political advisors since he was governor of Georgia. He's a really fascinating guy and incredibly knowledgeable, but for the most part, as also a drug advisor working in Georgia during the heroin epidemic of the late 60s and 1970s, he wasn't terribly concerned about marijuana. He really saw it as a soft drug that didn't threaten the populace of America as much as the opioid epidemic of 40 years ago did. So when Carter came to the White House, he brought Bourne along with him and made him his chief drug advisor. And he essentially established a position where they really reduced the number of people who were overdosing and becoming addicted to heroin through a widespread methadone clinic system. But he was very much so suggestive that, you know, the 1972 Schaefer Commission report was the thing that his White House administration was going to follow. And that was not a problem for Keith Straup. Straup was close with Bourne, was helping to write drafts for Bourne of Carter's statement in 1977 that suggested that the punishments for the crime should be no more harmful than the crime itself, which was his tacit support of decriminalization, until Bourne began to support the Mexican government's use of paraquat, which is a very strong herbicide on their illegal marijuana crops, using basically American helicopters that were also being used to eradicate poppies and things like that. This really bothered Keith Straup, because some, not a lot, but some of the marijuana that was still being trafficked across the southern border was laced with paraquat, which could be incredibly harmful for the people who might ingest it. So Straup, who was also kind of struggling with a little bit of a cocaine addiction was a little bit unruly at the time, invited Peter Bourne to his Christmas party in December of 1978, and there, this is where the story gets a little dicey.
Yeah.
Basically, it is reported by several people, although denied by Bourne himself, that when Bourne arrived, Keith Strop brought him up to a private bedroom in the townhouse where the party was being held. And there, Peter Bourne snorted a couple lines of cocaine. And Keith Strop didn't immediately go to the news outlets with this information because he kind of wanted to use it as blackmail, assuming that Bourne would continue to support the Mexican government's use of paraquat with American agreement. But he kind of said, without actually using his name, that maybe someone in the Carter administration is using illegal drugs. But Bourne incriminated himself in July of 1979 when he wrote a prescription for Quaaludes for his young secretary, who was going through a breakup and was just having a really troubled time, and he used a false name. So ultimately, the person, the secretary's roommate who went to pick up the Quaaludes, she gets arrested for trying to pick up this drug that was being abused at the time, and false prescriptions were a little bit rampant. Obviously, Peter Bourne, his name is on it, so this becomes a huge scandal, and Bourne has to resign. And all of a sudden, when Carter's chief drug advisor resigns for prescribing Quaaludes, which were used as a sex stimulant at the time, and all of these rumors are circulating that he's using illegal drugs himself, and Carter just cannot move forward with support for decriminalization. The drug issue becomes way too hot, and it basically ends the push for federal decriminalization in the 1970s.
And not only that, but then Reagan beat Jimmy Carter in the 1980 election, and that was an even bigger change, it seems, in drug policy.
Absolutely. If Carter had won again in 1980, maybe the vehement anti-marijuana movement of the Reagan administration, or of the 1980s, I should say, wouldn't have become so powerful. But he didn't. He lost. And when Reagan came to the White House, his wife, Nancy, was really looking for a platform. She was incredibly unpopular when she first arrived in Washington. She was seen as a frivolous social climber and kind of like a Lady Macbeth figure who was really pushing her husband onto the national stage as a grasp for power. And her advisors and her sort of colleagues said, well, how about this adolescent drug abuse prevention thing that some of these parents are really pushing? And Nancy Reagan ran with it and became one of the most prominent national and indeed international figures for preventing adolescent drug abuse in American history as a whole.
By the time Nancy Reagan and others were referring to a crisis in teen drug use, though, what was going on with the actual numbers?
They were dropping, of course. It really wasn't as much of a problem, not at least in the early 1980s. In between the peak of adolescent marijuana use and the rise of the crack epidemic in the mid to late 1980s, there was a lull, really, where adolescents weren't using illegal drugs, really, in any sort of worrisome numbers. And it was the parent movement activists and Nancy Reagan who continued to promote the idea that there was a real problem with this, because essentially they needed that platform to continue to exist so they could survive.
There's some really interesting history here about the creator of the original Just Say No campaign. Who was that?
Oh, an Oakland grandmother named Joan Brann, who I wasn't able to speak to, but I really find her to be such a fascinating person. She was a longtime activist for her community. She was an African-American who celebrated Black cultural pride. She really worked with engaging her Oakland neighbors and trying to, you know, instill a sense of community and neighborliness in her neighborhood. She went to D.C. for a couple of years to work, and she was very involved in politics and everything here, but then went back to Oakland in the mid-1980s because her husband died and she inherited a house, and it was just time to go home. When she returned, Oakland was a very different place. Drug use and drug dealing was quite rampant, and it really worried her, particularly for the health and safety of the children in her neighborhood who were walking to school in the morning, and she decided to do something about it. So Just Say No, the original Just Say No club program, grew out of that same sense of community service in Oakland that birthed the Black Panthers, right, who were serving free breakfast to community school children. It grew out of a need that children in Black urban areas had for alternatives to, you know, drug violence and things like that, a safe place that kids could go to avoid all of these things that were surrounding them.
So a long way from its origins to the White House. And then there's some other interesting detail in here that I hadn't heard before about corporate brands that benefited from Just Say No.
Oh, yeah. Well, once Nancy Reagan got involved, which occurred actually relatively rapidly after Just Say No's formation, it was irresistible to someone who's turned the prevention of adolescent drug abuse into her main platform, it becomes a national phenomenon. And it really does get away from its specific focus on 9 to 14-year-olds. Nancy Reagan was recommending it for everyone, adults alike. And it gets away from its urban origins. And because it was so popular, it becomes irresistible to corporate brands who see it as little more than a marketing technique and a sense of like a halo around their brand because they too support Just Say No. So Procter & Gamble, the company that makes, you know, everything from brownie mix to paper towels, basically stakes claim to Just Say No with the White House's tacit approval. They take Joan Brand and her partner Tom Adams off of the board of directors. They install a bunch of corporate people to direct and control the organization. And within a year, they have sole ownership of everything that Brand had worked so hard for.
And ultimately, was there any success to report for Just Say No?
Well, there actually was. Because P&G had so much money, it became a pretty powerful and prominent international organization with about $5 million to play with. But as far as it actually preventing adolescent drug abuse, I think it would have stayed far more powerful if it had remained a sort of small-scale, community-oriented organization the way Joan Brand envisioned.
Let's talk about some of the other players in the book. Mary Jane Rathbun had some efforts with marijuana. Tell us about that.
I love Mary Jane Rathbun, also known as Brownie Mary. I think she's a fascinating person. She died in 1999, so I wasn't able to speak to her. But she was originally from outside of Chicago and moved to San Francisco in, I think, the 1950s. And she sort of saw the neighborhood. She was in the Castro District. She saw her neighborhood transform as it became one of the gay cultural centers of the United States. She was a waitress at IHOP. She was very easygoing. And by the time she was about 35, she actually was smoking marijuana regularly to help with the pain in her knees from being on her feet all day. She becomes very involved with the gay rights movement and the marijuana movement in the 1970s when she meets Dennis Perron, who runs the Big Top marijuana supermarket. And she starts cooking brownies for him, infused brownies. And that's how she gets her nickname, Brownie Mary. She gets busted in the 1980s, and she's forced to serve. She's forced to do community service, and in doing that, she actually starts working with the Shanti organization, which helps people with terminal diseases. Because she's realized that a lot of her neighbors and her friends, whom she calls her kids, are all getting really, really sick. No one quite understands why, and she starts working with HIV/AIDS patients. She also starts to realize that her marijuana brownies can really help people struggling with HIV, with wasting syndrome and with pain and with chemotherapy. So she ultimately is one of the pioneers in using marijuana as a medical treatment for a wide variety of illnesses. And she dedicates her life to treating victims of HIV/AIDS and to helping pass Prop 215, which legalized medical marijuana in California in 1996.
Wow, so the AIDS epidemic played a prominent part in getting people to lighten up on marijuana, at least as a medical remedy.
It was huge. I can't quite overstate how important it was, because it was the first disease, or series of diseases, I should say, that introduced people to the concept of using marijuana as a medical treatment. Now, of course, it quickly expanded, and people undergoing chemotherapy or people suffering from glaucoma or a variety of other illnesses realized marijuana's medical utility as well. But it was HIV/AIDS that really thrust it into the national spotlight.
Once we had the widespread use of medical marijuana and so many states adopting it, was it really just a matter of time before there was an effort to legalize it for recreational purposes?
Well, it took quite a while. The biggest, mover for accepting or recognizing the potential for legalization, for recreational legalization, was the 2010 publication of Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, mm-hmm. where she points out that since the peak drug war of the 1980s, enacted in the wake of the crack epidemic, African Americans have been incarcerated at rates that are unprecedented in the entire world. We incarcerate more African Americans than South Africa did at the heart of apartheid, at the height of apartheid, and one in three African American males are currently somewhere in the justice system. It was an incredibly disheartening and enraging book that really woke people up to what had happened and why so many people had been incarcerated for nonviolent drug offenses. Now, Alexander doesn't specifically discuss legalization. I think she mentions it once. She talks maybe more about decriminalization. But people took the pronouncements that Alexander made in this book and decided, well, there is something we can do to enact social justice on a larger scale in America, and that's legalize marijuana. It already had basically a 20-year history of being recognized and used as a medical drug, so why not recognize that we use it as a recreational substance as well?
So given the up and down and up, and just a few seconds left here, Emily, are we looking potentially with the Jeff Sessions decision last week at another potential down moment?
I think it's more saber-rattling than anything else, but it's frightening to see the federal government renew its interest in prosecuting marijuana.
All right, we will see where things go. A lot of history behind us, though, in Grassroots, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Marijuana in America, written by historian Emily Dufton, who joined us today in the exchange. Emily, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, take care.